first speaker pointed out, the subject of our today's lecture is psychism dangerous? And we are all familiar that these days there is sudden spurt in psychic activities. Psychic powers are being displayed. There is curiosity regarding the exhibition of powers. And newspapers, magazines are full of articles on things like hypnotism, mental healing, past life recall, tarot card analysis, and what have you. And one finds that, is it a mere coincidence that there is a sudden spurt in these psychic activities and this interest which is aroused in psychism? Well, on superficial level, we may feel that it is because the problems of humanity are more of the mental kind, that they are not able to find solution to their problems at the physical level, that they are, say, going in for more and more of psychic cures and so on. And we find that there are self-styled babas and swamis who are taking maximum advantage of this, and they are cashing in on, we can say, this psycho-religious hunger which is there in people, so that at a nominal fee they will say that, okay, we can give you happiness and peace of mind, show you secret ways of attaining to complete health, peace and all that. And people are gullible. They are rushing in. Even educated people, we find, will not ask for the basis or rationale for these things. So the psychologists, some of them, have called this as the age of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is split personality. And we find that there is this splitting in man of his emotional nature and his intelligent nature. As it were, nobody is intelligently questioning the basis of these things. If you are told, say, that you do these breathing exercises and you will have some knowledge and you will see things. All right, you will see things. But theosophy says that they never stop seeing things. There is no control afterwards over these things which suddenly take place in you. However, the real reason why there is this sudden spurt in psychism is given by theosophy in terms of evolution of man. We are told that in every round, one of the principles in man develops, and we are told we are in the fourth round, and it is the desire principle, karma, passions and desires, which is supposed to be developing and has almost completely developed, and we find it is at the fore, in the sense that there is lots of interest in sensual things, sex and display, power. All these things are seen not just in West but also in the East. So also theosophy says that in fact, we are lagging behind. When the mind develops, we find that this sort of display of psychism, psychical activities, is bound to be there. When the mind develops completely, there would come a moment of choice between good and evil, and you're told that the race will be the race of gods later on when the right choice is made. But we are in the what is called as the age of transition. This is a transition period where the mind is not fully developed, but it's in the process of being altered. And that is what, we won't read the first part of this quotation, which speaks about this very thing, that how, when the passions and desires, the karma principle is at the uppermost, what happens. But the second part of it says that as the mind is being evolved more and more, as we proceed in our course along the line of race development, there can be perceived in all countries the beginning of the transition from the animal possessed of the germ of the real mind to the man of mind complete. This day is therefore known as transition period, when men's minds are only preparing for an alteration. Man is not yet fully conscious, and reincarnations are needed at last to have the complete incarnation of the whole trinity, that is the higher nature of man, in body. When that is complete, the race would have become as gods. And we all recall how H.P. Blavatsky, in the esoteric character of the Gospels, points out at one place that when Sun enters the sign of Aquarius, psychologists will have some extra work to do. As she says, that the idiosyncrasies, the psychic idiosyncrasies of people will have undergone a radical change. Not only that, we all know how she points out in the five messages the formation of a new sub-race on the American continent. And she says that with the formation of the new sub-race, wherein we find from all over the world people are attracted to this American continent. Also, along with these formations, certain psychical activities are going to come to the fore. And it is writing right back in 1875, it is almost a prophecy and also a great caution, as we see in the second quotation, how she points this out. She says, as the preparation for the new cycle proceeds, as the forerunners of the new sub-race make their appearance on the American continent, the latent psychic and occult powers in man are beginning to germinate and grow. Your position as forerunners has its own perils as well as its special advantages. Psychism, with all its allurements and all its dangers, is necessarily developing among you, and you must beware lest the psychic outrun the manasic and spiritual development. Psychic capacities held perfectly under control, checked and directed by the manasic principle, are valuable aids in development. But these capacities running riot, controlling instead of controlled, using instead of being used, lead the student into the most dangerous delusions and certainly of moral destruction. Watch therefore carefully this development inevitable in your race and evolution period, so that it may finally work for good and not for evil, and receive in advance the sincere and potent blessings of those whose goodwill will never fail you if you do not fail yourselves. And however, before we proceed, let us see what is psychism. What is its derivation? It is derived from the Greek psyche, and that is, as far as man is concerned, refers to that part of man's mind which is emotional and not a truly wise aspect of man's mind. And here again, in glossary, psychism itself is defined as was brought out in the preliminary remarks, it is every kind of mental phenomena from mediumship to higher sensitiveness, hypnotic receptivity and inspired prophecy, also clairvoyance in the astral light as well as divine seership and so on. Now we know that our today's topic is related to the third object of ULT. Last Sunday we had the second object, the comparative study of world's religions in order to show the brotherhood of religions. The third object says to investigate the hidden mysteries of nature and the psychical and spiritual powers latent in man. Now, this investigation itself can be undertaken in two ways. One is the actual experimental investigation, and the other could be just finding out the basis, the laws, the philosophy which underlies these various psychical phenomena, powers, etc. And we all know that theosophy, right from the time of HPB, has never encouraged the first kind of investigation, and that is the actual experimental investigation as far as the psychic realm is concerned. We know how the master, the great master, writes in his letter when certain Europeans told him about their interest in developing the psychic powers and that they should be taught how to develop these psychic powers. Very stern reply is given by the master of wisdom. He says, if the theosophists say we have nothing to do with all this, that is, the lower classes, the inferior races cannot concern us and must manage as they can, what becomes of our fine professions of benevolence, philanthropy, reform, etc.? Shall we devote ourselves to teaching a few Europeans, fed on the fat of the land, many of them loaded with gifts of blind fortune, the rationale of bell ringing, cup growing, spiritual telephone and astral body formation, and leave the teeming millions of the ignorant and the poor and the oppressed to take care of themselves and their hereafter as at best they know? Never. Perish rather the Theosophical Society with both its hapless founders than that we should permit it to become no better than an academy of magic and a hall of occultism. Very strongly here it is said that no encouragement is given as far as developing of these psychical powers is concerned. But then, why did H.P. Blavatsky herself exhibit certain phenomena at her time? This is for two concrete reasons. One, she wanted to, because in her time and as also now, show it to the scientists who never admitted of the existence of a super sensuous or super normal region, that there does exist such a region, and that just as there are physical laws governing physical realm, there are psychic laws governing psychic realm and also spiritual laws governing spiritual realm. She wanted to point out that, well, every man has in him the germ of all these psychical powers, which are displayed by a Mahatma. But they are not conferred upon Mahatma as some sort of a gift, but he displays it by a long training, proper discipline and experiments. And we can also, as Mr. Jash points out, that the great musical ability which is, say, exhibited by Bach or Beethoven is not common, but it is natural. In the same way, the psychic powers which are displayed are not common, but they are still natural. There are occult forces and processes and the laws governing them, just like, as we said, the physical laws are there in nature. The second reason was that she wanted to leave behind her a record of a different sort, because in her time, we know, spiritualism was rampant, and that was a false kind of spiritualism, that people were indulging in mediumship, practices of necromanticism, calling of the dead and so on. So she wanted to show that there is something more than even this, and also the rationale for the same. We know that in 1847, in America, in the city of New York, in a small village, a person called John D. Fox, he occupied his new residence there. And we are told that from the first night, there started these rappings and knockings in the house. And the smallest of these Fox daughters, Kate Fox, was thoroughly amused. And once she just snapped her fingers and said, "Do as I do." And the response was there. So she was even more interested. And she found that, yes, this invisible agency is communicating, answering questions. And in few days, there was complete excitement in the whole of the village. The recently dead peddler of the village, his spirit was called, questions were answered, and this is how began the whole practice of calling of the dead. Unfortunately, of course, H.P. Blavatsky, if we turn to Key to Theosophy, she gives a long list of the names of people who were mediums and such practices were indulged in. Unfortunately, however, they thought that they are communicating with the real spirit of the dead. But really, as Theosophy says, it is the psychic corpse, it is the kamarupic shell, it is the dross which is left behind by the real man which goes to Devahan. And that it is nothing really amazing that this kamarupic shell should communicate and give off impressions, because it is the nature of astral body in man to sponge-like absorb the impressions which are made on it while the person is living. The thoughts, the feelings, the desires he has, they are impressed on the astral body, and the kamarupic shell, a part of which is astral body, retains it. And we are told that the nervous fluid of the medium, along with the elementals, the elementaries, the imagination of the sitters, all of these work in galvanizing this particular spook, kamarupic shell, ghost, whatever we may choose to call. But it is interesting for us to see that what is a medium? In the pamphlet number 13, on mediatorship, we are told that a medium is a person who is influenced by the outside people to an abnormal extent, such that he loses his control over himself and is not able to have control over his actions. And it says that this kind of being influenced by others around could be active or passive, it could be conscious or unconscious. And we are told that a person can be influenced by the other person and can become his slave. He can submit his will actively or unconsciously. Now, this other person or other being, we are told, could be an idea. It could be something like patriotism. It could be something like greed for money. It could be hatred. It could be envy. It could be jealousy. Any passion. And we say he's possessed by it. He's obsessed by it. So you become slave to your idea or a certain passion. Even that is a form of mediumship. You could be submitting yourself to other being, which is your own higher nature. In which case, writes HPB, that you have an artist, you have a musician who is able to compose a good piece of music, write a lovely poem or a good story. And many a times, she says, people are not aware as to what is the source of their inspiration. Many a times they would write a great scientific treatise or a good piece of poem and keep on thinking that it was the personal spirit of Shakespeare or Faraday or Tyndall that is writing through me. But the point that is being made is, we are all mediums. In a sense that if we were not having a little bit of mediumship in us, we would not even be influenced by the good influences which are there. A chela is a medium to an extent that, of course, with actively he submits his will to his Mahatma, the master, and is influenced by the Mahatma. But the danger of mediumship then lies in the fact that this person is one who is to an abnormal extent influenced by the outside things, and it is something which happens passively. Now, this is not something far away. This mediumship, we are told, if you are not careful, you can run into it, in the sense that look at our world today. We find advertisements, as Aldous Huxley in his book Ends and Means points out, that right from the childhood we have to show the child that this girl who is wearing, say, a silk gown and a very beautiful girl tells you to use a particular toothpaste. There is no earthly connection between that toothpaste and the beauty of the girl and the silk gown that she is wearing. You have to judge on the merits and demerits of that toothpaste. Same way, you want to join the computer class. People around, you see the hoardings of NIT classes, and seven people tell you that they are the best, and you just go and join. I mean, it may appear to be a very small thing, but in smallest of things, what we are told is you must rationalize. Rationalize, think for yourself, collect the information for various things, judge for your own self, and then decide what you're going to do. If you don't do this, slowly and gradually, we are accepting ideas. What is written, say, in the newspaper editorial, in the magazine, in the advertisement, if we just go on passively absorbing, then the day will not be far off when we may actually slip into that dangerous kind of mediumship. And we are told the extreme mediumship and the dangers that it involves, of course, not at our level, but the mediums that we were talking about, who indulge into seance room practices, etc. What does she say? Mr. Judge points out why mediumship is dangerous. He says, to become a medium means that you have to become disorganized physiologically and in the nervous system, because through the latter is connection between the two worlds. The moment the door is opened, all the unknown forces rush in. And as the gross part of nature is nearest to us, it is that part which affects us most. The lower nature is also first affected and inflamed because the forces used are from that part of us. We are then at the mercy of the wild thoughts of all men and subject to the influence of the shells in Kamaloka. If to this be added the taking of money for the practice of mediumship, an additional danger is at hand. For the things of the spirit and those relating to the astral world must not be sold. So here again, he's pointing out to that danger, which again and again in Theosophy we point out that if you are not on your guard, then you need not go to a hypnotist. You are already being psychologized and hypnotized by that great hypnotizing agent, which we call as astral light. That the thoughts and feelings of people, which are of the baser kind, they are there, as he points out, in the grosser levels of this astral light, and we are bound to attract these thoughts and feelings. And that is why before you know, you do something of which you are not capable. Sometimes you find a person suddenly committing a crime, suddenly telling a blatant lie, and we say that, but it was not like him to do it. Now how has he done it? So this is there, the influencing, this psychologizing or hypnotizing can happen in this way if you are not on our guard. Now, here again, we are therefore shown in the 10 items the difference between a medium and an adept. That whereas in a medium, things are happening involuntarily, without control, the adept, he is in full control of all his faculties, senses, powers. Anything that is done, it is done with his knowledge, deliberately, and he can stop the happening of that particular phenomena. One of the feats we have been just studying on Friday is the withdrawal of the astral from the physical. And in the medium, it nostril is withdrawn, he appears in a cataleptic trance. When the adept, in his case, the astral is withdrawn, we are told that he appears as if he is in a state of meditation or a ground study. And the same thing, if we carry forward to another thing, that is clairvoyance, we are told that there is a difference between psychic clairvoyance or ordinary clairvoyance, and there is something called a spiritual clairvoyance. There are two very good articles on this in the Bangalore series pamphlet, where he says one article is Delusions of Clairvoyance and the other is Shall We Teach Clairvoyance? And he points out in the first place that those who are, say, displaying the clairvoyant perception, ability to see in the future, ability to see things happening at a distance, not most of them, he says, are not physically and mentally well-balanced people. It's very rare that a healthy person will show this kind of clairvoyant perception. Not only that, how many times are they able to correctly see in the astral light and tell you the true thing? Because there are many hurdles, many difficulties. First of all, he says there are many, many layers of astral light. And an ordinary clairvoyant can see only in the few layers. Whereas it's only a spiritual clairvoyant who can look into all the layers of astral light. Second thing is that there's this making of images. After all, what you see in the astral is the image. And he says that when a person thinks a thought, there is an image. But when he sees that thing, suppose I think of a chair, there is an image in the astral. And when I see the chair, there is also an image. But the two kinds of images are different, which an ordinary clairvoyant cannot differentiate. So he gives the example that suppose a mother is anxious about her child and she thinks that her child has met with an accident. She vividly thinks of it and a picture is impressed in the astral light. Now the ordinary untrained seer or clairvoyant will say that yes, the accident has taken place, whereas it was just the result of the mother's fancy and imagination only. So only a true clairvoyant can be able to, would be able to tell us about the real thing. Then again, all our psychic perceptions of this sort are colored by our own feelings, thoughts, preconceptions, and so on. So, in fact, he gives the example of no less than a person, Swedenborg himself. He says that yes, he could do, a person like him who could see Stockholm burning from where he was, some 300 miles away. But even he mistook the denizens in the astral light for something else. And when he described certain denizens as the inhabitants of Mercury, the description given was as if they were wearing the clothes which were worn by the people in Europe at his time. So he says that it is thoroughly, it is not something which you can rely upon, what is being, say, told by the ordinary clairvoyants. And as for learning to develop this power of clairvoyance, clairvoyant perception, seeing at a distance or telling of the past and future events, he says it is not really advisable. Because according to him, he says that the mediums are the people who don't have control, and to them this happens just involuntarily. They would be quite ready to teach you for a fee. But really speaking, you should learn it, if at all, from a person who is very pure in his living, leads a clean life, he has the interest of humanity at heart, and he has control over this happening. That at will he can stop this clairvoyant perception. And he says that a person who is an adept, only him you can have all these characteristics, you can ascribe to him. So a person who is anyone less than an adept, you are not supposed to go and learn how to develop these clairvoyant perception. And if you just sit down and gaze in the water or gaze here and there in order to, say, induce passivity and then get this clairvoyant perception, he sounds a warning. He says, but what shall theosophists do? Stop all attempts at clairvoyance. And why? Because it leads them slowly but surely, almost beyond recall, into an interior and exterior passive state where the will is gradually overpowered and they are at last in the power of demons who lurk around the threshold of our consciousness. Above all, follow no advice to sit for development. Madness lies that way. Even Mr. Crosby has said, don't sit for development like this, because as we had been studying on Friday class, a certain amount of inner development a maturity of even the inner man is required. We can just recall, now that the Olympics are going on, if any one of us tries lifting 4 kilogram of weight like Malleshwari did, we can imagine what would happen to our muscles. In the same way, for these psychical powers, if suddenly they are developed and the person is not ready, we can just imagine what kind of damage can be brought on the inner, the psychic plane in man. And that is why we are cautioned to not really sit down for development and rush into this sphere. But let us see where this psychic realm really can be placed in the context. Mr. Jad gives an example. He says, suppose a person is journeying from one city to another. Then on the way, he will come across many rivers. And suppose his boat doesn't work, he must know swimming. He comes across a mountain. And suppose that the only way to cross is by digging a tunnel. Then he must know some little bit of engineering. Suppose he is losing his way and he is supposed to have the sense of direction. Then he must know the movement of the sun and be able to gauge as to in what direction he is going. But he says that would you mistake all these things, the knowledge of engineering, then the knowledge of the movement of the sun, would you get all entangled into acquiring that instead of, say, following the goal, and that is reaching that particular city? And he says something like that is there. Our goal is something different. The goal is living the higher life, realization of who we really are, and also realizing that we are not really separate from each other. And that goal, while we are pursuing that spiritual goal, just like in the case of the person in his journey, he comes across incidentally these various things and he's required to have knowledge of swimming and engineering and so on. So also we may have to encounter and know about these various psychic powers and phenomena. But that doesn't mean that you get entangled into them. The very first sentence we know in the Voice of the Silence is, these instructions are for those ignorant of the dangers of the lower Iddhi. Iddhi is the Pali word for Sanskrit word Siddhi. And she is cautioning here, bringing out the difference that there are lower course psychic powers and energies and there are higher spiritual powers and faculties. She therefore says that why is this knowledge given in Theosophy regarding the various psychic powers, the existence of astral and psychic realm, so that we are not waylaid. It is quite possible that a person, say, sits down for meditation, makes a certain progress, he begins to see light, he begins to hear sounds, and he feels that, oh, he's far, far advanced in spiritual life. And that he may be going then at a tangent instead of following his spiritual goal. And we have in the article called Astral Intoxication in Vernal Blooms, Mr. Judge sounding a warning. He says, when a student starts upon the path and begins to see spots of light flash out now and then, or balls of golden fire roll past him, it does not mean that he is beginning to see the real self, pure spirit. A moment of deepest peace or wonderful revealings given to the student is not the awful moment when one is about to see one's spiritual guide, much less his own soul. Nor are psychic splashes of blue flame, nor visions of things that afterwards come to pass, nor sights of small sections of the astral light with its wonderful photographs of past or future, nor the sudden ringing of the distant fairy-like bells, any proof that you are cultivating spirituality. These things and still more curious will occur when you have passed a little distance on the way. But they are merely outposts of a new land which is itself wholly material and only one remove from the plane of gross physical consciousness. Very, very clearly he points out that this is no advance and we are far, far away from being really spiritually developed and perfected. And we see that these whole three realms, the physical, the psychic and the spiritual, are spoken of in our reading. In fact, with that our reading began today, which said, this earth, O disciple, is but a dismal entrance to twilight, which precedes the valley of true light. The earth and its existence is been called as dismal entrance, full of sorrow and suffering and misery. And it leads to twilight. Again, this is a beautiful description in a single word of the astral region. That the astral region is like the twilight. Twilight is the dusk period, you know. It is evening, which is neither total night and darkness, nor the daytime where there is full light, and what you see in twilight, in the dusk. It's all hazy. You're not sure as to what you see. You may, as they say, may mistake the rope for the snake and the snake for the rope. You may grasp things, but not entirely. You don't know what is happening. And this is the illusive and the delusive nature of the astral realm and the astral region. Again, in that first fragment, these three are compared with the three states of consciousness. And the astral is compared with the dream state in man. Just as in a dream state, suppose you see a tiger and you want that tiger to run away, it will run away. If you want that tiger to attack you, it will attack you. In the same way, we can affect, in the sense that we have a control as far as the effect of the psychic region is concerned. We are told that the astral light is having its hypnotizing power, but only when we have the thoughts consubstantial in the nature. That is, if you have a kind of thoughts which are of selfish nature, envious, hatred, anger is there in you, then only similar thoughts you will attract. But even when you are maybe in the midst of very bad psychic atmosphere, the protection can be there in terms of your own pure life, good thoughts, pure living, higher living. This will act as a shield and a protection even against the bad psychic influences. And what does Mr. Judge have to say about this astral region? Why is it dangerous? Because the things happening on the physical plane, no matter what great the danger is, we have some idea about the physical plane. We can deal with it, some instrument, some weapon. But when it comes to astral realm, we are totally ignorant, unless of course you are going through the proper training and discipline. So he compares this astral region by saying, the astral plane, which is the same as that of our psychic senses, is as full of strange sights and sounds as an untrodden South American forest, and has to be well understood before the student can stay there long without danger. While we can overcome the danger of forest by the use of human inventions, we have no such aids when treading the astral labyrinth. We may be physically brave and say that no fear can enter into us, but no untrained or merely curious seeker is able to say just what effect will result to his outer senses from the attack or influence encountered by his psychic senses. So this is where he again points out the danger of the astral region and the nature of the astral region. So the H.P. Blavatsky, as you know, in Raja Yoga or occultism, puts all these arts on one hand, and she has called that chapter Occultism versus Occult Arts. And the surprisingly, under occult arts, you have things like Yajna Vidya, that is the power of ceremonies and rituals which awaken certain potencies of nature. Then Mahavidya or Tantrika worship, Guhya Vidya, power of sound, mantras, incantations, prayers. I mean, these sound really alluring and amazing to us when a person displays. But all of these, she says, they are occult arts, and she says they are like a rushlight. Rushlight is a dim light, like the light thrown by a candle, as compared to the light of the glorious sun, which is occultism or Atma Vidya. And Atma Vidya she places high as the true knowledge of the soul, and she says that Atma Vidya places no value on these various occult arts. And that is what is represented by the third hall, the spiritual hall, wherein, says Voice of the Silence, you may come encounter your master, and in that region you should look out for your guru or master. And here again, we may see a little about living the spiritual life. Even if you start with, say, the motive of living the spiritual life, again people feel that, oh, they are glamored by this whole institution of guru-chela relationship, and then they feel that, oh, I want to become a disciple and a chela. Again, as to that, Blavatsky says that it involves practical occultism. Offering oneself as a chela, she says, is an easy thing. But to constitute yourself into an adept is the most difficult thing that any person can undertake. Because chelaship is a psychic resolvent, and it burns to dross, of course, all the lower and the base nature of man, leaving behind the pure gold. But the moment that you vow to become a chela, she says that all the latent germs, the person may be walking very respectably in the society thinking that he's such a good person. But if there is a hidden germ, say for greed for money, lust, sensuality, then she says that the germ is sure to sprout. And if you think that by the strong effort of will you are going to suppress these things, like the thin layer of ash covers the smoldering fire, then we know that a little whiff of wind and it just lights, ignites into a big flame. Like that, your passions will, as she says, lash to desperation. And then, unless and until you are morally strong, you are not able to control this sudden coming before, face to face with your local. Unless and until you are morally strong, you are not able to control this sudden coming before, face to face with your lower nature. And that is why she says that for the present, even students of theosophy and outsiders, that you remain content with preparing your mental luggage. Get yourself acquainted with the theoretical aspects of occultism. What are the dangers? What are the defects? How you have to first make yourself morally and mentally pure. So in the five messages, she says, the ethics of theosophy are more important than any divergement of the psychical laws and facts. That first purify your nature. First try living the good, virtuous, moral life. And then attempt or even try to lead the life of practical occultism. Now why is there so much of emphasis on good life, purity of motive especially? We say that the difference between the white and the black magic lies mainly in the motive of the person, whether his motive is pure or not. Why this emphasis is there? Mr. Jaj was asked in one of the articles in Vernal Blooms that can you illustrate as to what would happen if the people of today are given suddenly these psychic powers? And he says it's not very difficult to tell what will happen. In fact, he gives examples of his time. That people were approaching mediums and spooks for what? To find out what are the stocks and shares in which they should invest money, how to find hidden treasures, and things which are, say, related to money matters, so that they can, that time the mining was going on of gold and silver. So whether they should indulge into these gold and silver mining or not. And fortunately, Mr. Jad says that the information given by the mediums was not always correct. But the cases in which the information was found to be correct and the people did make a lot of money, what did they do with that? He says, mainly, reasonable amount was paid to the medium and they settled back in enjoying a nice, cool, comfortable life and hardly any thought of, say, devoting at least some of that money for, say, the upliftment of the poor. And again, this should not surprise us if he just, the student was watching this program, Kaun Banega Karolpati, and there you see people are winning some lakhs of rupees and the question is asked, what do you think you want to do with this money? And the answer generally given is, oh, I'll go on a world tour, I'll take my family to Disneyland and I'll establish my business. But only two people so far have said that, no, I will use it for upliftment of women or children or some such thing. So even with a physical thing, like money, they are doing this. So what are psychic powers if you come across that? And again, even in our times, especially the student has read in Gujarati newspapers, a long column of the Babas, various Babas, talking about, we will do for a fee, Vashikaran, Mohini, this, that. All these Tantrika names are given. That is, bring about the ruin of that, your opponent, bringing about his ruin in the business as far as his health is concerned. So this is the purpose for which the powers are being used. And so wisely we are told that purify your motive first. Because you may feel that no, you are not all that selfish, but you, before you know, you may end up using these powers for selfish purposes. And that's why isn't it said in the very first page in the footnote, quoting from Bhagavad Gita, as Krishna himself says, don't worry. As long as you have your senses under control, your desires are under your control, what will happen? He who is engaged in the performance of the yoga, who has subdued his senses and who has concentrated his mind in me, Krishna, such yogis, all the siddhis, stand ready to serve. That again and again we are told that yes, these powers will come as a byproduct. You just live the life necessary. And yet, in a beautiful small article in one of the older TMs, we are told, we are all magicians. And there it is said that, well, do you want to really develop powers? We all have the power of imagination and the power of thought transference. And you can develop it. Mr. Judge, in letters that have helped me, says that I can influence your mind, writing to a student, not by, say, playing with your subconscious, but I can firmly and kindly think of you. And if my motive is selfish, there will be difficulty in reaching you. But if my motive is pure, then my thoughts should readily reach you. Elsewhere, we know in one of the articles, he advises the students that, well, if you feel that nothing can be done, that people are like that, nothing can be done about theosophy, then if your attitude of mind, your thoughts are, say, lacking that will and that earnestness, then nothing will be done, because your subtle minds will meet other minds and whisper into their ears in the night, nothing can be done and nothing will be done. But, he says, if you are earnest and devoted, then your mind will meet other minds and tell them, theosophy, help and hope for thee, and it will result into sudden awakening of interest in theosophy on the part of the people. Elsewhere, he says in the very first letter, that if you want to do something good, but you are unable to, suppose something is happening in Orissa and you can't go there, but if you have a strong desire, strong thought, strong will, then your desire will strike like a vulcan, and you will find that done which you long to be the doer of. Now this is all, again, let us say, it is a power. Power on the positive side of the thoughts and of imagination. But however, we would again recall what Light on the Path says, instead of really wishing for the powers, that the power which the disciple shall covet is that which will make him appear as nothing in the eyes of man. And carry with us this idea which even St. Paul, when he is told about, asked about spiritual gifts, he says, I will not have you ignorant about spiritual gifts. That he enumerates them and says in the end that charity or love is the highest gift. That is what you should try to cultivate. And in that very article, this is the last paragraph, which gives us a very sage advice. It says, it is in and through the incidents of daily life, in work well done, in duties thoroughly performed, that we today can most readily make progress in the higher life. Slow progress it may be, but at any rate sure. These are stepping stones to better things. We advance most rapidly when we stop to help other wayfarers. We receive most when we sacrifice most. We attain to the largest measure of divine love when we most unselfishly love the brethren. We become one with the Supreme most surely when we lose ourselves in work for humanity. Friends, now very little time for asking questions. Question is on Friday study class we were studying that you should stop all attempt at developing clairvoyance. But in the article we were studying, Culture of Concentration, he points out that there will be the first thing that will be developed is the clairvoyance and clairaudience faculties. Just like the child begins first to say walk, hear and see before he starts walking. Now so. Can it not happen that even before we have purified ourselves completely, that these powers develop? Now, he's talking about culture of concentration. And there, he is first telling us that you have to get rid of vanity, fear, envy, anger, and so on. Now, in the process, this, what he's talking about, is still the natural process. He's not saying that this will happen in a person who is sitting down for development. Here, This is when you are sitting down for actually developing without even attempting to say control your anger or fear or envy or jealousy. But when this development takes place, at least to a certain extent, the student feels that to a certain extent, the person has attempted to control his fear, anger, envy and all those vices which are there in him. And then proportionate to that, it feels that this power of clairvoyance and clairaudience may begin to develop. It is not as if suddenly he will start seeing in the astral light all the time and correctly. It may, here and there, maybe it may begin with hunch, it may begin with say a little bit of seeing, unconscious seeing in the astral, and then as he purifies, this may become more. Because what we are talking about is the person who is really taken to heart to live the pure life. And we are told that when a person has made that resolve, a certain stage is reached when the guidance of the masters is there, who will see to it that certain of his faculties are sealed at times, that they will not, say, begin to operate too soon before he is ready. So the Culture of Concentration article is really